Okay, I guess we should just start. I want to say one thing about this morning's, and then maybe I'll take some questions and then we'll move on. Somebody reminded me of this, and I might as well do it now. I was going to talk about correlations later. But if you notice this particular reverse correlation function, so I mentioned that it likes large negative voltages. It likes to see transitions from positive to negative. But this does something that's a bit troublesome. And that is, if you notice, it doesn't go to zero. They don't plot it over here on the right. But it doesn't go to zero. Now, you would think that if this is sort of the stimulus that causes a spike, if you can sort of simplify that way, you would expect it to go to zero out here because this is reflecting the fact that there's just no preferred stimulus wave in the past. And I think somebody asked you, but you know, it's this neuron looks back about 150 milliseconds into the past. But you would also expect by causality that the neuron shouldn't react to what's about to happen, right? It shouldn't preferably fire a spike if the stimulus is about to do something. And yet, they just stop plotting it. But it's clear if they kept plotting it, that it wouldn't go to zero. Now, that actually shouldn't have happened in this case, although I think I know why it might have. That depends on whether the stimulus itself is correlated, right? Because it actually would be okay for this reverse correlation of function to be non-zero over there if the stimulus was correlated, and that is if the value of the stimulus during the past here predicted the stimulus in the future, then there's no problem with this function being non-zero on the sort of acausal side. And that illustrates a confounding feature that'll come up again, and that is that this function, if you're not careful, this function convolves two features. One is the fact about the neuron itself, namely what does the neuron respond to, but the other is it reflects certain features of the stimulus itself. For example, correlations. And you know, if the stimulus, for example, was periodic, you would see this structure repeating, you know, down the axis, which clearly had nothing to do with the neuron. The fact that you see the same structure way over here is not a reflection of the fact that the neuron has such a property, but just that the stimulus does. So to get rid of that, the convention is to use uncorrelated stimuli, to use white noise, basically. As soon as we raise the thing, I'll give you mathematically what that means. It basically means a stimulus that from one time to the next is completely uncorrelated. And then this should not happen because neurons presumably can't tell the future. Now here, the reason I think this is happening is because these authors actually used a filtered white noise, not a pure white noise, and somehow they must have had some correlation left over something. I don't know exactly what happened, but with a white noise stimulus, that should go to zero. Otherwise, some fishy is going on.
What was the stimulus here? Was it high-level stimulus or directly on the neuron level?
It was on the fish. It was actually electrodes in the water, okay, putting an electric field on the fish, I mean, in the neighborhood of the fish. Exactly. At arbitrary high frequency in principle, but obviously there's a cutoff always in reality. But you try to make the cutoff faster than anything the neuron would be able to recognize. So, it's certainly not a realistic signal. It's not the kinds of things in real life. I mean, this gets, we really should talk about this more when we get into this linear system thing. You know, in a linear system, it doesn't matter what you probe it with. As long as you probe it with a complete set of stimuli, you should be able to predict anything. Now, in a nonlinear system, that all falls apart. So the idea that you can probe this thing with white noise and learn something about its responses, let's say to natural scenes or something like that, natural stimuli, really relies on the linearity assumption very strongly. And, you know, you can see. Okay, so the kind of, maybe we should write it out because we're going to need it pretty soon. So the idea of a white noise stimulus is you look at a stimulus-stimulus correlation function. Maybe I'll write the correlation functions because we're going to need them. So we had the stimulus response correlation function, which was the average over the duration of the experiment, T is the duration of the experiment, of the firing rate at one time and then the stimulus at actually a later time. That would be QRS of tau. By analogy with that, we can define a stimulus-stimulus correlation function, which would be exactly the same expression, but just with the stimulus with itself at another time. And the feature of a white noise stimulus is that this correlation function is proportional to a delta function. So you can think of it as a variance. This has a kind of a funny unit, but a sort of a stimulus variance. That's a parameter that sets how wiggly the signal is. And then this delta function just says that there's no correlation from one time to the next. But of course, at any given instant of time, the thing is you know, acting like a random variable. It has this funny feature that, so a delta function, say somebody asked me, I never really defined it. A delta function is a limit, actually, of a series of functions that get narrower and narrower and taller such that their integral is 1. And the delta function is sort of the mathematical limit of that. So this looks like a random variable, which is uncorrelated, and at every instant of time, it actually has infinite variance, which is true, because if you don't have infinite variance at each instant of time, this doesn't add up to anything. So if you want, you can think of it, if you make time discrete, as that the variance is going like 1 over the delta t that you use in the thing. Anyway, that's white noise. We'll need that a little later. And then maybe the other thing that I'll write down here is the relationship between the correlation function between the response and the stimulus and this spike-triggered average, which if I just invert what I wrote for you this morning, we're going to need that too. So there's a relationship between this correlation function and the spike-triggered average. Okay, so let's get on to response prediction, which will start out looking different like that, but it's going to converge to the same thing. So the idea is we want to build a model that would predict this firing rate in response to an arbitrary stimulus. And we do it as really kind of the functional analog of a power series. In other words, we could say, well, if they didn't have any stimulus at all, which remember, the way I define the stimulus, this really just means that the stimulus is equal to its average, that the neuron might fire at a background rate. So R0 is the background rate of the neuron, and it's the zeroth order approximation. And then we start writing terms that are going to involve higher and higher powers of the stimulus S, although in this analysis, I'm actually not going to go past the linear term. So what's the linear term? If I write it down, I think it'll be kind of obvious what it means. The linear term looks like this. And basically what this is saying is, you ask, okay, it's just like kind of what I said before, that the response is going to depend on the stimulus in the past. It can't depend on the stimulus in the future. And so tau here is, again, a measure of how far into the past am I talking about. And then this function D, which is called the linear kernel, is a measure of how strongly the neuron depends, the firing rate depends, on the value of the stimulus, tau, milliseconds, or whatever, into the past, okay? So you're weighting the past values of the stimulus by that function, and then you're just summing over all of the contributions from different times going into the past. I've written the integral going all the way back to the beginning of the universe, but of course, this D function probably goes to zero because the firing rate isn't going to depend on the stimulus more than, you know, a few hundred milliseconds into the past. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm sorry
about it. Oh yeah, I forgot to say what you told me to say. Did you have a different? Right. You could think of this as a transfer function from this stimulus to this response. Or it's called the linear Wiener kernel sometimes for reasons I'm about to show you. So this is actually part of a general expansion called a Volterra series, which is exactly, it's a functional analog of a Taylor series. You know, you can respond, you can express any function as, you know, a constant term plus a linear term in x plus x squared plus x cubed, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you can do the same thing for functions. One function in terms of another, and any function, I guess there must be some sort of regularity conditions and like that, but any sort of well-behaved function can be written as a series like this, where the next term is going to have two integrals over two different times and some kind of kernel that depends on two variables, and then two stimuli, like that, and then three stimuli and four stimuli, I won't bother to keep writing. So in general, you could imagine a more complicated thing. People do these sorts of fits maybe up to two or three terms. It gets harder and harder to extract the kernel. So what's the job here? If you want to write such an approximation, of course, the thing you've got to extract is what are these d functions. You could call that d1, d2, etc. It gets harder and harder as you go on, and I'm going to stop just at the linear term and ignore these higher terms. But this is a general, as I say, functional analog of a Taylor series is called a Volterra series, and then Wiener rearranged the series such that it would be easier to extract these coefficients. He sort of orthogonalized the series so that they would be easier to extract. But to the order we're working, it doesn't make any difference. So this is something called the linear Wiener kernel as well. And we're just going to forget about all this, these higher terms, which get pretty complicated. And talk about a linear approximation like this. And in fact, probably to, I'm going to call this L instead of R because later on I'll go back. Just also to remind you, this is a linear estimate. If this course isn't the real firing rate, it's a linear estimate of the firing rate in response to the stimulus S. And it's got all sorts of problems which we'll try to patch up as we go along. Okay, but just to keep in mind, you know, for example, it's a linear function, so if S got very negative, you might start predicting a negative firing rate, which is clearly ridiculous, and things like that. So there's problems, but let's go on. All right. So anyway, within a linear framework, what do you do to choose the best possible value of D? Well, what we're going to do is just to choose it so that the average answer is as good as possible. And the way we do that is the following. The error at any time is going to be this linear estimate minus the real firing rate. I also want to use the value L because I want to use R for the real firing rate. So in other words, in order to extract this D, what we're going to do is imagine we were given some data where we know the firing rate, the real firing rate that the neuron produced, and we know the stimulus, and now we're going to try to match it so that the squared error averaged over the experiment, so we're going to integrate this over the duration of the experiment, that you can think of as the error, or the square error, we're going to minimize that, okay, and make it as small as possible. It's obviously a completely logical thing to do, to choose the D such that that error is minimized, and then we'll be done. Okay, so let's write out what that is. I just have to substitute in what L is. We substitute that expression, right? So it's 1 over t, the integral. And then we have in here, I'm just going to call it tau prime. It'll make it easier later on. So let's call the integration variable tau prime instead of tau. So again, it's the weight, oh, I forgot the R0 term. It's the background firing rate plus this integral weighting in the past, how much sensitivity to the stimulus you have in the neuron. So that's L. Right, and then we subtract R and square. All right, so now, in order to minimize this, I don't know how many know functional derivatives, but it would be the exact analogy of if this was a function, not a functional. I'll say what that means in a second. If it was a function, we would take the derivative of this error with respect to whatever variable we wanted to determine, set it to 0 in order to find a minimum, and solve that equation. We'd be done. Well, this is similar. So in this case, D is the variable that we want to determine. But D isn't a number. It's a function. And an expression like this, which depends not on a number like a function f of x depends on the value of x, this depends on a function. this error is called a functional, and the derivative that we're talking about is a functional derivative. In other words, we want to know, we're going to determine this whole function at every point, not just a value of it. But I'm not going to get into the intricacies of functional derivatives, but they really are very much like regular derivatives. You just have to think of the function at every point as if it's an independent variable, right? So I can go point by point and then take a derivative with respect to every point. And give a few, take a few dts, that's kind of what we're going to do. So I think if I write down the answer, you'll probably convince yourself that it's right. So again, I'm taking a derivative with respect to a function, or if you think of it as a regular derivative, it's like taking a derivative with respect to the value of the function at that particular point. And that's why I made this a tau prime, so I could use tau for the derivative variable. Okay, but now, but the rules are not really so different than regular derivatives. I mean, if I took a derivative, if I just forgot about functions for a second, I took a derivative with respect to d, I would, you know, the square would go away because I'm taking a derivative of a square. And so this is going to be 2 over t, I guess, the 2 from taking the derivative of the square, integral from 0 to t dt. Then I have the thing in the brackets, so r0 plus integral from 0 to infinity. So this is whatever, the chain rule. I can never remember the names of these stupid rules. Okay, so that's the thing in the bracket. And now I take the derivative of what was in the bracket, and that's where it gets a little bit tricky. But with a functional derivative, what you have to think of is you're taking the derivative with respect to the value of the function at a point, so this integral goes away, because most of the integral doesn't depend on the value of that point, only at the point where tau prime equals tau. Then it's going to depend on that. But then otherwise, it's just the same. I mean, when you take a derivative, the d goes away, because that's what I'm taking the derivative with respect to. And I'm just left with this s of t, but with tau prime set equal to tau. So like that. Okay, so that's the functional derivative, and that's what I got to set to 0 to find the minimum. Okay, so let's do it. Okay, this morning I mentioned, so this simplifies somewhat. This term here where I have r0 times s integrated over the whole experiment. If you remember, this morning I mentioned to you that, would it be better if I take this down? If people are having trouble seeing, I can dump this for a second. That we're assuming that the average value of the stimulus is zero. So, and r0 is just a constant. So this is going to be, this term is going to be zero. In other words, I can ignore this term because it integrates to zero. That simplifies things. So I can write this answer, if I ignore the 2 as well, since I set it to zero, as 1 over t, the integral, I'm going to flip the order of the integrals. D of tau prime. So what I'm doing is I'm doing this term, this times this, but I'm just flipping it around a little bit. In fact, I'm going to flip it around even more. From 0 to t. So prime s of t minus tau. Okay? So that's this term. And then I can set that, since there's a minus sign here, I'm going to flip it over to the other side and set that equal to, what I got? 1 over t integral of r of t s of t minus tau. Okay, so that's just the same expression rearranged and written as an equation instead of equal to 0. Okay, so this is the equation that this optimal kernel has to satisfy. And on the right-hand side, you'll recognize our old friend, the reverse correlation function, right? On the right-hand side of this equation is exactly this expression, the correlation function between the stimulus and the response, except again, evaluated at minus tau instead of at tau. So in fact, something that's very closely related to the spike-triggered average on the right-hand side of the equation. On the left-hand side of the equation is the stimulus-stimulus correlation function. In fact, if I just shift the integration variables, and I'm going to imagine that these integrals over such a long time that I can ignore the fact that I'm slopping over the boundary a little bit. So if I shift the integration variable, this is going to just be the correlation function of the stimulus with the stimulus, evaluated at tau minus tau prime. So this equation becomes an equation linking this D function to the stimulus-stimulus and the stimulus-response correlation function. And it does exactly what we were just talking about when I just started after lunch. Namely, this term here is saying, okay, how does the stimulus and response correlate? And that's a property of the neuron. And this term here is saying, well, in addition, you can have relationships between the stimulus and the response just induced by stimulus correlations. This is this effect of being able to predict the future that I told you about, right? In other words, if the stimulus is correlated with itself, the neuron can actually start predicting the future. And I don't know if Bill Bialik's going to talk about it, but there's a whole flipped version of this where you try, instead of I'm trying to get the response from the stimulus, you can also try to get the stimulus from the response. Yeah. And then you use predicting in the future the whole game. I mean, this term is very important. Okay. Now, you can solve this equation for any functions. The easiest way, if you know Fourier transforms, this is a convolution. That's just, if you don't know that, the form of this integral is called a convolution. If you take the Fourier transform, this just becomes the product of the Fourier transform of D times the Fourier transform of Q equals the Fourier transform of QRS. And so the formal solution to this thing is, if I do a tilde for a Fourier transform, is that the D is the ratio of the Fourier transform. It's actually complex conjugate because of the minus tau. To the stimulus-stimulus correlation function. Okay. And this is a nice way to think of it as being that what D reflects is property of the neuron with the stimulus-stimulus contribution to that divided out, removed. This is what pulls out the fact that part of what you see is due to the stimulus, has nothing to do with the neuron. But we actually won't use this because if you're doing this experiment, you can make your life easiest by using one of these uncorrelated stimuli. So if you do this experiment with an uncorrelated stimuli, not only, you know, makes experiment easy, it makes the math easy too. Because for an uncorrelated stimulus, if this is a delta function, then this just becomes sigma s squared times d of tau, right? The delta function collapses the integral down to that point, and that equals QRS of minus tau. And you've got your answer that the optimal kernel is proportional to the reverse correlation function, which in turn is going to be proportional to the spike-triggered average. So you have this nice closure that the spike-triggered average has this intuitive sense, but it also provides the best kernel for predicting the response in terms of the stimulus. And maybe I'll write down the final answer someplace. Write it over here. Okay, so I don't want to write so lonely. Yeah, okay. So the answer is that the optimal kernel for linear estimation is, what does it come out to be? The reverse correlation function divided by the variance of your stimulus that you used during the experiment. But I can also turn that into this if I divide by R, right? So it's the spike-triggered average divided by the average firing rate times the stimulus autocorrelation function. Whatever. Anyway, I mean, the constants are not so important. The key is that the same kernel that you get, or the same function that you get from doing a spike-triggered average, then provides the best estimate of the linear firing rate. And let me do a little bit more math, and then I'll show you a third interpretation of this function. And this is the one that's often used as a sort of a shorthand. And that comes about by saying, suppose you take this linear estimate at face value, and you ask, what stimulus would be the most effective at making the neuron fire? So in other words, I'm going to say, well, let's assume that this linear thing is, it really is a good estimate of the neuron response. Okay, so, what am I doing here? Let's see. And I ask, what stimulus would give you the best response? Well, clearly I have to constrain that because this is a linear function, so the answer is an infinitely strong stimulus would give you the best response. So a reasonable constraint is to constrain what you might call the power of the stimulus. So in order to make this a defined problem, you could put in the constraint that the integral over tau, over time, let's call it, let's say average over the experiment, doesn't really matter, of the square of the stimulus, you hold that constant. So you could sort of think of that as like the power of the stimulus. How much energy are you putting into the stimulus? And I don't know, I don't think I'll bore you with the math, but I'll give you a homework exercise. So write down this stimulus, write down this constraint, put a Lagrange multiplier in front of it, and take the derivatives. You can see it by eye, basically. What you're going to get, you're going to take the derivative of this times the Lagrange multiplier is going to give you an S. You're going to take the derivative of this with respect to S, and you're going to get a D. And what you're going to find is that the most effective stimulus is, in fact, the D function. So you can interpret this expression in a number of ways. You can sort of think of this integral as a sort of overlap integral, asking how well does S match D at any time? How well, sort of like a template thing. So let me do it. If you have S here, and so what do you say?
You were trying to get at the idea of what D would have called sort of matched filter.
Yeah, the matched, I don't know if the matched corresponds to the match that I'm talking about, does it?
I think it's a primary verse version.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you wanted to know the response here, what this is effectively doing like is taking the D function. I'm plotting it here, you know, whatever it looks like, and seeing how well the two match. And the better they match for a given stimulus power, the faster firing rate you're going to predict. And since this kernel is the optimal stimulus, you're sort of saying, how close to the optimal stimulus am I? Is this stimulus at a given time? Okay? Everyone understand that? So it's very intuitive, I guess that's the point. All right, any questions? Yeah. Right. I mean, you can obviously see that if you put in a logarithm, you know, it can't be equally linear in both, right? So historically, it's just been done intuitively, basically, especially in the visual system. I'm about to get this, I might as well say. In the visual system, what's been taken to be this S is just the light intensity of a pixel relative to the background, and just linear, just that. Yeah, and for example, not a bad idea would be to try this whole thing, then try it again with logarithms, see if you do better, you know, something like that. I don't know, well, there is a method, a guy named Fred Riecke, in his thesis, I know, worked out a sort of a double one of these where you first write the stimulus as a parameterized function and then you optimize the best way to describe the stimulus and the response at the same time. You could imagine doing something like that. I'm not going to get into that, but it's obviously tricky. I mean, it's a non-trivial question what you ask.
Mm-hmm.
You mean how much data is it going to take to get? Yeah, I'm trying to think of my. I don't know in my head an easy way to do that. I mean, obviously it's a question of how accurately are you determining these functions.
You know, by reading out trials and estimating me over and over again for every case in that trial, right, you'll get distribution.
See how much it.
That's
I mean, I guess their methods of doing it. I don't have a magic thing of from formula to give you to say that's enough data, about all. Yeah.
All this stuff is a nice procedure, but the problem becomes if the underlying linearity hypothesis is correct, right? So in experiments, probably there are some parallel collections.
Okay, good. Good question. So, okay, let me tell you the patch. You're correct. So obviously there's problems with this. I mean, I mentioned one, that the firing rate can go negative. It can also go arbitrarily high, right, if you just keep cranking up the stimulus. And that doesn't happen with thrown neurons. So there's a patch for this, which doesn't fix everything, but it helps. Oops. What was this? Never mind. That formula's gone forever. Okay. And actually, I guess that is the next subject. So it was a good question. So clearly there's some problems with this. You wouldn't expect it to work that often, and it's got some obvious problems with neurons in the sense that they don't fire arbitrarily quickly, and they don't fire negative for sure. So one thing that you can do, this is not a rigorously provable right thing to do, is what's called adding a static nonlinearity. And that means I apologize for this. For this purpose, I want to define the L to just be the integral. It'll just be, the notation will help. And then write an estimate of the firing rate as being a background times some function of L. Okay? This is called including a static nonlinearity. It's done all the time. And it's a way of improving things, okay? Now, there are problems with this. Let me tell you the good news first. There's a theorem called, due to Buskang is the name. There's a theorem that if the noise you use is not only white noise, but Gaussian white noise, which basically means, so this means that you choose the stimulus at every time with a certain variance, but from any distribution. That hasn't been specified. Gaussian obviously means that at each time you choose it from a Gaussian distribution. The theorem states the following, that suppose the firing rate of the neuron really was given by this formula. So you assume the formula is correct. And you followed this whole procedure that I just told you, which I derived in a linear approximation, you would still get the right answer. In other words, even though this function is here, you can go through the whole thing, and it really has to do with the fact that higher order moments of a Gaussian distribution are all related to lower order moments, to the second order moment. That this D that optimizes the D that the neuron really would have would still be given by this formula, or it would be proportional. At most, it would pick up a proportionality constant. That's the good news. The bad news is who cares, because we don't think the neuron really does this. So you can show that in general, this D kernel that I've been using is no longer the optimal kernel. You could try to do the minimization with respect to this function and everything, but it's a mess. So what people in practice do is just patch it. At the end, include a static nonlinearity to improve some of these things. And it does improve the fit quite a bit. I'll show you how you can do that. But you no longer are rigorously optimal, number one. And I don't want to deceive you into thinking in any way this replaces those higher order terms in the Volterra series. You're still only, the reason called a static nonlinearity is you're still only allowing the stimulus to be evaluated at one point at a time. You're not looking at a correlation between stimuli at different points. You're just allowing it to be squared or cubed or whatever. Anyway, so this is what's done, and there's an easy procedure for figuring out whether this is going to help and to figure out what the function is. Namely, you just plot suppose you have a bunch of data and you compute this L, so you compute a linear prediction of the firing rate, although I took the constant out just because it's easier to do that. And then you made a scatter plot of the L values that you got as opposed to the real firing rates, okay? So you'd end up seeing you know, something that looked like this. The points would be scattered and maybe they'd look like that or whatever. But the point is that that is the function. That's the static nonlinearity right there. It's clear that rather than using this linear prediction, you'd be better off to put in some kind of function that goes like that. So you could fit this to the data and get a better estimate. And so most of the data is actually based on this formula, or most of the fits to data, with a static nonlinearity, which minimally throws away the negative rates. I mean, that's clearly something you would want to do. For example, this curve, the original thing that goes like that, the minimal thing you want to do is get rid of that. But in addition, you might want to put in some curvature. And I'll talk about that when you do the visual system. So that's what I said, sort of quasi-linear. It's still based on a linear approximation, but it's slightly better than that. Yeah?
Is it clear that the optimal linear kernel has to be causal?
So in this case, we haven't allowed it not to be, right, essentially, because we're only looking into past. Certainly, you know, if this is correlated, you can do better by looking forward in the future. And it really then depends on how you know, whether you want to use that depends on how you think of this. If you really wanted the best possible estimate, yes, you're better off looking in the future. If you want to think you're sort of duplicating what the real neuron's doing, the neural neuron doesn't get to look in the future. So it's sort of a matter of taste. But I've written it down as a causal. I think actually, you know, when I wrote the Fourier transform, that's not causal. That's an acausal field.
I think it's actually maybe sort of a matter of an open issue, because you might say then you can wait a certain amount of time for your
observation. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is going to come up if somebody does the decoding. That's much more relevant for the reverse process. In other words, if you try to estimate a stimulus from a response, then you can wait a little bit. And that's sort of the equivalent of looking in the future. Here, I guess you could say, well, what if I wanted to predict a firing rate a few milliseconds ago. Then you're allowed to put in this delay. You know, so it's kind of, it depends on what you want to do with this. But I want to stick to the causal one.
I've got a question regarding the noise. Even if you are able to produce such a stimulus, I mean, like noise, it could be that the receptor neurons are filtering out some part of the spectrum. I'm just asking.
Right. Yes, in fact, so of course it's impossible to really make this because you would have to have infinitely small bin sizes and do it. So what people in practice do is to estimate exactly what you say. Neurons can't respond to infinitely rapid stimuli. They have a cutoff frequency, which is remarkably low. For visual neurons, it's, you know, 10 or 20 hertz. And in many neurons, in many sensory systems, it's pretty low. So that you build it to be white up to that point, and then you don't care anymore. So that's right. The other problem is that some neurons don't respond very well to white noise. And then, you know, this is a great technique in theory, but if you don't get any spikes, you know, there's not much you can do. So then often people, this is again of how you define a stimulus. They'll define, for example, rather than using white noise on a video monitor, you know, is just, you know, confetti, this kind of thing. Visual neurons are not particularly responsive to that. So some people use, for example, bars with random orientations that are chosen from white noise or something like that. It's clear you've got a compromise between the mathematically ideal stimulus and something that'll make the neuron respond. Okay? Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this mathematical problem has a unique solution, but it certainly could change the optimal stimulus, you know, as a result of attention or something like that, if that's what you mean.
Mm-hmm. In that kind of method. Since these are,
one of the neurons fighting. It's also the effect of all the other neurons and connections other than the stim.
Yeah, right, okay. So, I mean, let me try to answer. I don't know if I exactly answered your question, but you raised an important point that I should have stressed, and that is that, so this is a really black box neuron, right? You're just saying in comes a stimulus, and out comes a response, and you're just building a map from one to the other, and it makes no statement about what's really going on in there. So, in fact, for that reason, I'm going to come back like tomorrow and try to build models of where is this coming from. So don't, you can't really tie this to the circuit. And I'll give you an example. When I talk about, in a few minutes, I'll talk about neurons in primary visual cortex. The map goes directly from stimulus to the primary visual cortex. You don't talk about the LGN, you don't talk about the retina, because it's just a map. It makes no statement about the circuitry. That was one. What was the other? Maybe that's all I need to say. So don't get too tied up with the real circuitry. But we will come back and try to make models that give responses like this based on circuitry. So this isn't a mechanistic or circuit model, just a description. It's a response of one single neuron. But whether that comes from 10,000 neurons in here or one, you don't care. If it works, it works. Absolutely. That's exactly right. As you go down the thing, this gets worse and worse. Right.
I'm a bit puzzled by the fact that you talk about white noise as a stimulus. That would mean that the stimulus is also stochastic.
Mm-hmm.
That means the plasticity of the stimulus adds to the plasticity of the neuronal spiking. I think this must make.
Well, no, because you know the stimulus. I mean, it's generated stochastically, but it's not unknown. You know exactly what it's doing, and you're correlating the response with the stimulus. So it's not adding noise. You can really think of this as a way of probing all stimuli, right? White noise has built in it to it everything. Right. No, that's not true. It's a random walk, right? It's variable on all times scales. In fact, it has a flat power spectrum, so it has wiggles on every possible time scale. But what you say is exactly right. What I was saying with your question, that above a certain point, the neuron's not going to care about the high frequency part. So it's like, you know, if you look at the power spectrum, the white noise is flat, and then the neuron has, on top of that, you know, some kind of window in which it responds to the frequencies, and what happens out here is irrelevant. But so in fact, people don't really build white noise, they build something like that. But they make sure it brackets the neuron. Okay, all right, where was it? Static nonlinearity, I think we're ready to actually do something with this. I've done everything. Oh, let me just tell you, okay, so let me see if I really want to do the visual system next. Yeah, well, I'll wait until, maybe I'll do this. Let me just show you this in action. And then maybe what I'll do is I'll set up the visual system version, which will just take a little bit, and then we'll take a break, and then I'll show you the visual. So as I say, to me, the value of all this, I mean, it's a nice technique for studying neurons, is that it really gives you a lot of insight into the visual system. I think, hopefully I'll show you, you'll see that. All right, I'll show you an example. Again, this is again from this Spikes book. Of doing exactly what I've been talking about. So, and you know, to see the limits, I don't want to overstretch that this is going to work, you know, very precisely, but it kind of works. And this is probably, these are, you know, ornery people, these spikes people, so that they make it tough when they do this example. Okay, so here's an example of a neuron. This is the H1 neuron that you will no doubt hear some more about during these lectures. This is a neuron that responds to large-scale motions in the visual field of a fly, and it's used for attitude control. So if the fly starts to roll over, it sees in the visual field the roll, it responds to that velocity by making the appropriate adjustment in the swings. And so here what they're doing is they actually put a drum around the fly and rotate the drum to simulate the visual motion. And so here is the velocity of that rotating drum that's providing a visual motion to the fly. And it's again generated by some sort of quasi-white noise process, Gaussian in this case. Here are spike trains. This is just two out of the examples of, they recorded many spike trains that, from this preparation. An advantage of this preparation is you can get huge quantities of data, because a fly just, you know, just sits there, whatever, the neuron sits there flying, buzzing away for a long time, firing away. Okay, from these spike trains, they did a reverse correlation analysis. The reverse correlation function actually, unfortunately, isn't on this graph. They extracted that, and then this is just a linear one. There's no static nonlinearity here. And the solid line is the prediction of this linear model of the response, and the dashed line is the actual firing rate of the response. So, you know, kind of misses some of the high frequency transients, but it sort of gets the general flavor. And that's probably, you know, how it goes. It's again one of those, whether you want to see the glass as half full or half empty, I guess, how well this does, but it's not terrible. All right, so what I really want to do, in order to extract the firing rate, that was over many.
It's exactly the same.
Exactly, although it's not really random. It's the same exact white noise every time, exactly. Yeah, but I don't know the answer of that. The thing is that because they can't spin, so this is an actual physical mass, right? So they can't spin it infinitely rapidly. So this is filtered white noise. I guess, you know, it's not white, obviously. It'll start vibrating and like that, yeah, exactly. So, but again, I think they would argue that the filtering is beyond the range of the neuron, although, I don't know if that's true. You're right, it doesn't look particularly white. okay, let me do the visual. So let me set up to do the visual system and then we'll actually do it. Should come back to that. So the place where this really has been applied with great, at least it's had a huge impact on the field, and I think fairly successfully. And I think if you're at all mathematically inclined, there's no way you can understand the visual system unless you think in terms of these linear filters, because that's just the way the thing is described. So let me just slightly generalize this to what you have to do in the visual system. It's pretty trivial, but just so we get all the equations down. So all of these experiments, you have like a computer monitor or some kind of video monitor, and you're going to put up a stimulus on it and try to predict the response of a visual neuron. It could be in the retina, it could be in the lateral geniculate nucleus, or it could be in the primary visual cortex, but I'm not going to go beyond that. And this is described in terms of pixels, so we can think of x and y coordinates of a particular pixel. And then you can think of everything that I just did as being applying to one pixel, for example. But now, in this case, the stimulus is like you have a whole set of stimuli. The stimuli are parameterized not just by time, but also you have to say which pixel you're talking about. So that's an obviously generalization. And then this linear estimate you're not going to only sum over the time in the past, but you also have to sum over pixels. So if I write it down again, I think it'll be kind of obvious. So first of all, we have this integral going into the past of the effect on the neuron in the past. But then in addition, we're going to have an integral over the whole computer screen, because potentially, we don't know, but we'll see, you know, anywhere on the screen, light anywhere on the screen could have an effect on the neural response. And so the D function in this case is going to be a function not only of the tau variable, but also of X and Y. So where on the computer screen you're talking about, and then, of course, the stimulus evaluated like this. Okay, so these, it's not a convolution in X and Y, it's just a sum, right? In other words, I'm just doing what we did before, but then taking every pixel, doing it for every pixel, and adding them all up. And now this function is now telling me how much does pixel XY affect the response of the neuron, tau, you know, the value of the intensity, tau milliseconds in the past at the point XY. All right? But then everything else follows. I mean, this, again, you know, the DXY and tau is going to be proportional to the, I'll write it as in the old way, let's say, the sum of the stimulus at the point XY, you know, tau milliseconds or whatever before every spike. So something like that. So it's like everything I've just done with an XY index floating along to tell you pixel by pixel what's going on. Just think of each pixel as an independent stimulus. So what I'm going to do, I will do it after the break. What I'm going to do after the break then is basically talk about these functions. So for the visual system, they're more complicated than what we're talking about. And a description of those functions is a description of what we know about the visual system up to the primary visual cortex. It really essentially is. And I'll also talk a little bit about the static nonlinearity. So again, we're going to have the estimate written as a background plus some function of this linear estimate. I'll talk a little bit about the static nonlinearities, which is going to be the difference between, for example, simple and complex cells. So this formalism works beautifully there. So let's take a break, and then I'll take you through the visual system stuff. So, the visual system, this is the payoff for all our hard work. We get to see how the visual system works. I'm going to go straight to the primary visual cortex where things are interesting, and then go back to the LGN where things are completely boring. I don't know why that was so funny. Okay, so the tricky thing about this function, so what we're talking about is this function, D of X, Y, and tau, which, again, is how much does pixel X and Y weight the response a time tau ago into the past. Now, the problem is, of course, this is a function of three variables. It's a hard thing to plot. And so we're going to look at various projections of it. Here's one. I mean, I guess the best thing would be to show you a movie, but I don't have a movie. I'm sure the people who really do this have movies of it. That's our focus, I guess. But this is like a snapshot movie. So this is a plot of the D function, or if you want, the spike-triggered average. Actually, there's two of them here. For two neurons in the primary visual cortex of a cat. This is from the Freeman lab. But it's done as snapshots. So what they call T here is what I call tau. So this is 30 milliseconds into the past, 75, 120, et cetera, going backwards in time. And then this is just a picture of the screen, if you want, or part of the screen. It's the XY picture of the screen. And then the shaded regions show regions where D is positive and regions where D is negative. So this, the solid lines here, this is a region where D is positive. This is a region where D is negative. And the rest of this junk is probably just noise. you can see how much it jumps around. But this is what's called the receptive field of the cell. So receptive field has a bunch of meanings, but one is it's by definition the part of the field where D is different from zero, but it also has come to mean aspects of the structure of that as well. All right, so what you see here then is the receptive field prior to this, they don't really get anything. That's why they haven't bothered to show a snapshot. So first of all, you see a latency of about 30 milliseconds. In other words, it takes 30 milliseconds for the signal to get from the eye of this cat into the brain. And then you start to see a dependence which sort of maxes out at 75 milliseconds in the past, a very strong positive region, strong negative region. Now, the positive regions are called on regions because remember, this is also the optimal stimulus. So this is a region where if you illuminate above the average background, remember now S here is the illumination of the pixel relative to the background because the average has been taken out. So this is what's called an on region. This cell wants to see light in that region, and this is what's called an off region. That's where D is negative. Negative means darker than the background. And so this cell wants to see a boundary between a light region and a dark region. And it wants to see it oriented in the vertical direction, right? It wants to see a bar of black there and a bar of white there. However, that structure changes in time as you go back, and it reverses. Again, very similar to the electric fish cell that we saw. So as you go backwards in time, the on region becomes on the left and the off region on the black. So what this cell really likes to see is a white-black boundary that turns into a black-white boundary, or vice versa, depending, I guess, which way you see it. And this is a similar sort of cell. This one's a bit more complicated. We'll talk about these are called separable and non-separable. This sort of looks like a non-separable one. Let me just see where I'm going. Okay. Now, there's another way to plot these, and especially ones like this. If you notice, let's say this receptive field, it's not that y-dependent, right? It's elongated in the y-direction. It has more structure in the x-direction. So, for example, in the y-direction, you know, these are pretty much symmetrical. So another way to plot these so you can get them on one piece of paper is to plot the tau variable on one axis and then the x variable on the other axis and just suppress the y, don't show it. And that's what these plots are. Except now these are out of the original paper, so they're not reversed, unfortunately. I promised you I'd reverse them, but... Okay. Maybe I'll. Let's see if we can get these. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to show them. Sorry, the axes are going to be all goofed up, but I'm going to show them always this way. Because I guess I could do this. Then one of the axes. I don't know. I'm going to get dizzy going up here. Let's show them this way. Okay. I'll give you a quick tour of this. This might be a little confusing, but we'll get back to it. This is a mistake. I'll get back to it. It's too complicated. Okay, now, these receptive fields are split into two categories. And again, it's a convenience in order to do this split, but they're expressed two ways. Some of them, the space and time part splits. So you can write this as a product of a function of the spatial variables and a product of the time variable. That's called a separable space-time receptive field. And obviously that makes life simpler because we can talk about the space part and the time part independently. So I want to talk about that first. It gets rid of the problem of these three variable plots. But not all cells are like that. Some cells have a receptive field that's what's called non-separable, and that's what that plot was about, but I didn't want to show it. Okay, so now let's talk about a separable one, because now it's going to be easy to plot things. So I'm going to first talk about the time part, and then talk about the space part. Okay. And the time part, you kind of already saw what it looks like. Actually, the one I showed you was pretty much separable. So this guy here, if you notice, the structure of the receptive field, of course, it's not exactly true, but the receptive field is roughly constant over time. There's a blob here and a blob here, blob over here. All that's changing is it's being multiplied by a factor that increases, then decreases and changes the sign, and then goes back to zero. And so this is an approximately separable space-time receptive field. And here, this is the wrong. Did I need to what? Push it up. Okay. But also, I don't know. This must be an old one before I flipped them around. Sorry. And it also is mislabeled. But anyway, this is a plot of the temporal part of the receptive field. So if you notice, remember that other cell started maybe about 30 milliseconds or so? So this is the factor. This is actually, it says ds, but it's really dt. Sorry. This is the factor that multiplies. It's zero up to about 20, 30 milliseconds. That's the latency effect. It comes up to a maximum that is right about, you know, and in that cell I just showed you was 75 milliseconds. Maybe this one's more like 60 milliseconds, but that's roughly corresponding to that point here, right? If I plot, where am I? I guess I got to. Okay, so this point here, when the receptive field is just getting cranked up, that's here. Here's the maximum. That's about, for this, these aren't, you know, that fit to the same cell, but this is about 60 milliseconds. Then it reverses, and around 140 milliseconds, it's fully reversed. For this cell, that's a little later. That's more like 200 milliseconds for this particular cell. And then by 250 or so here, the party's over, and there's no effect anymore. This is a very typical shape, as I say, for neurons all over the place, that they like to see reversals. Okay, this is saying whatever structure was in the space at this point, what the neuron wants to see as time goes this way is the reverse of that structure followed by the structure, whatever the structure being determined by the space part of the receptive field. So that's a typical thing, and if you want to know the function, people have generally fit to this, it looks like this. So the dt of tau looks like some parameter. Maybe this is alpha. I think it's alpha tau to the fifth minus alpha tau to the, it's kind of a weird, ugly function, 7 factorial. It's basically an exponential decay. So that's what you're seeing here, is a gradual exponential decay. Then a tau to the fifth, that's what causes this slow rise, okay? Because there's a high power of tau, it takes a while to get going. And then it's a difference of two terms, a fifth power minus the seventh power. So here the fifth power is winning, here the seventh power is winning, and here the exponentials killed the whole thing off. Yeah, it likes derivatives in time. That's a good, yes, exactly. With the scale of the derivative being kind of 100 milliseconds in this particular case. Okay, and you know, not surprisingly, well, I guess I've got it on the same plot. I mentioned before, in the answer to one of the questions, that these cells tend to start rolling off in their responses about 10 or so hertz. Well, that's no accident. This is 100 milliseconds. And you do that. So for example, once you know this function, and here's a good exercise, I give you it all as homework. If you want to know the temporal response property of this neuron, so for example, how would it respond to a cosine oscillating image, okay? One that's reversing by that, all you have to do is take this function and convolve it with a cosine, right? Because remember the formula for the answer. In this case, the answer is going to be, let's do it. The kinds of, maybe I should give you the stimuli we're going to use. Okay? Well, I'm going to get out of myself. Yeah, I'll do this later. In setting a separable space-time receptive field, it doesn't hurt to use a separable stimulus. So, for example, we can have the stimulus have a spatial part that only depends on x and y that I'll talk about in a little while. That's the pattern of light. And then modified, for example, let's say by a cosine function. So it's that would be what's called a counterphase stimulus. Namely, it's a stimulus that has a certain pattern of light and dark on the screen and then oscillates between that pattern and the negative of it, the flip of it, with a certain frequency. And if you want to know the linear response produced by this thing, okay, what you have to do is integrate the spatial kernel, the space kernel times the spatial part of the stimulus, and I'll talk about doing that in a second, but to get the temporal response thing, you've got to convolve the temporal part of the kernel, which is this mess here, by the cosine of omega t minus tau. So it's just a matter of doing an integral. It's a bit of an ugly integral, but it's not impossible, so go home and do the integral tonight. You want to do the integral of that function times the cosine, and you'll determine the amplitude of the response as a function of frequency, and you'll get the right answer. I mean, real neurons really do respond like that. So you get a function that looks like this, typically. Namely, the amplitude of the response goes up with frequency. That's the thing that it likes, changing stimuli. This zero reflects the fact that typically neurons in primary visual cortex do not like stimuli that don't move or oscillate in some way. And this one's pretty low. I don't know what, remember what parameters I used when I plotted this curve. This one peaks at a few hertz, starts to roll off, and by 20 hertz it's all over. And that's very typical. Neurons in primary visual cortex are really sluggish in a sense. They like changing stimuli, but they don't like stimuli that change very rapidly. Remarkably sluggish, you know. We think of ourselves as being such quick processors, but these are very sluggish neurons. Okay, the real guts of visual systems neuroscience is in this baby, because it has the whole structure, spatial structure of the receptive field built into it. Now, the way this is extracted, again, remember the whole thing, is to build a white noise stimuli. That just means flickering checkerboard. Of course, in neither space or time do you go to infinite resolution, but you have a checkerboard on the screen. It goes blah, 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 and you do a spike-triggered average, and you see what you get, and I'll show you in a second what you get. I should mention that I'm only talking about the responses of these visual neurons to non-colored stimuli, to black and white stimuli. Now, in the case of a cat, that's about all you get. Cats can just barely see color. They have terrible color vision. But obviously for a monkey or human, you would have the element of color in the game as well, which I'm just going to ignore. All right, so here are some experimental examples of applying this method to the receptive fields of neurons in the primary visual cortex of the cat. They're drawn both as contour plots, so this is x and y, and also as 3D plots where there's an xy plane, and then the height of the curve is the d function. So what you can see, this, for example, this has a structure very much like the cell that I just showed you. It's not the same cell. In fact, it's not the same experimental group. This is a Jones and Palmer. This is a really classic paper in visual neuroscience. But again, you have a positive region in the space now and a negative region next to it, so plus and a minus region, an on region and an off region. Of course, this is then modulated by this temporal function, but I'm ignoring that, so that if you showed a movie of this, you know, it would do this. But as just the space part, it has a look like this. Here's another one with a similar structure. You know, there's a variety of them. Here they are. What do I got next? Okay, so these have been fit by a whole lot of functions, but a particularly nice one to use is what's called a Gabor function. I'm not claiming it's the best fit or anything. I mean, people argue about this, but it's a nice way to think about these receptive fields. So, plot it over here, maybe.
So,
Yes.
Never keep a straight bond.
You know, maybe this one's kind of like that, but very typically you do not see just bumps. So, I mean, the answer is exactly what you say, that not only in time, but also in space, you like to see derivatives, you like to see edges, whatever you want to call it, contrast between two regions. And there really aren't, well, this here's one, but by and large, they tend to look like this, or even with three regions, or something like that. Particularly neurons of the visual cortex. I'll show you the lateral geniculate nucleus is different there. So it's just, and in the retina it's different. So this, what I'm talking about is primary visual. All is a tough one. All the ones they tell you about. I mean, this is, again, somebody was mentioning this before. People find the neurons that respond to the stimuli they use, you know. They're interneurons, but, so, I don't know. I don't do these experiments, so I don't want to say sort of what percentage of neurons that they come across that don't behave like this. There probably are some, but the majority will behave like this.
That's
a good point. Yeah, right. Okay, so I'm going to somewhat simplify this by assuming, if you notice, these receptive fields oscillate in one direction, okay? So in this direction there's an oscillation in space, whereas in this direction there isn't an oscillation in space. And that's very typical, but of course that could be oriented any way. I mean, they happen to draw the graph that way, but it could have been oriented that way. But I'm going to follow their example and always align the receptive field so that it's oscillating in the x direction. Just, you know, you can obviously rotate the coordinates if you feel like it, but it just saves writing a little bit. So a very typical structure for the receptive field is a Gaussian, this sort of mathematical fit. A Gaussian actually with two different widths would work better. So it's a Gaussian factor in the x direction with a certain width. That's kind of the envelope of this blob. A Gaussian factor in the y direction. That's this sort of blob going this way. And then what gives you the oscillation? You multiply by a cosine function. All right, and I've assumed here that the direction in which you're oscillating is the x direction, and then this phi obviously determines the phase of that that oscillation. And the nice thing about this is that this function, I'll plot you one here. Here I've done it in vector notation, never mind the equation. Here's a plot of such a function. Has this characteristic structure, and you can do a pretty good job of fitting these receptive fields with this. And furthermore, it kind of identifies all of the parameters that people use to discuss the selectivities of visually receptive neurons. So, for example, sigma x and sigma y are going to determine the size of the receptive field. Namely, how big a space in X and Y is the cell selective to light for. You can see in this example, if you go flashing lights out here, it'll have no effect on the cell. And the receptive fields for let's say a monkey will vary anywhere from about a tenth of a degree in the visual field to a few degrees as a function of the eccentricity. So you have big receptive fields out in the periphery, which is why you have a poor resolution out there. And in the fovea, you or a monkey has very small receptive fields where this whole thing would be only maybe a tenth of a degree in the visual field. Okay, then K is called the preferred spatial phase. Spatial frequency, I'm sorry. Okay, and it determines that it's the wavelength, if you want, of these wiggles, right? Because that's the cosine function making these wiggles. And that determines the spatial scale, if you want, on the which this derivative is being taken, or how we'll see it later, the kind of how you match. And then phi is called the preferred spatial phase. The preferred thing corresponds to the fact that this is the best stimulus for the neurons. So if you match it, you're going to get the best response. So this is called the preferred spatial phase. And that obviously determines, you know, where these wiggles are located. If you change that thing, the wiggles will move, you know, along one way or the other. And just to show you that this matches pretty well, I've just taken two of the examples. That I just showed you of the space-time receptive fields, and just kind of, you know, by eye, these are not the best fits or anything, whoops. But these are Gabor functions with appropriately chosen parameters that really do a pretty good job of matching these spatial receptive fields. So so it's a pretty good model of it. Somewhere. Sorry, what? Well, I mean, Gabor, Gabor function can be used to make wavelets, right? So.
They don't. They cover the time, the space, the space, plane, and the different.
So, I mean, I think that distinction would be you couldn't tell by one function. It would be a question of how you span the whole thing. So that's a question of the distribution of, for example, these parameters across the visual cortex. And you could ask, do they seem to be making a wavelet basis? It's been argued. I think the best thing for me to say is I don't know. I mean, I even wrote a paper on this, and I don't know whether that kind of basis is being made. Needless to say, there's a wide range of these parameters, but whether it's sort of just random or there's some systematic attempt to provide a more, for example, what we looked at is whether this basis is forming what's called a tight frame, which is part of this. The data just can't tell the difference. Okay, so I thought I had another plot, but at any rate, I'll just show you some Gabor functions. You know, these functions, as a function of the parameter, you can get things like with three, an on region and two flanked by two off regions, and you'll see cortical cells that look like that. You can see them with more wiggles. Oh, I did find the slide I meant to find. So here's something with an on, off, on. There's a five regions. You can see cortical cells like that. And in general, the more wiggles, the more selective the neuron is to particular patterns, obviously. And the number of wiggles really reflects what's called the bandwidth of the neuron. The more wiggles, the smaller the bandwidth, the more selective it is for spatial frequency. I'll show you that in a second. No, I was saying that this range anywhere from like a tenth of a degree to a few degrees, and it changes as a function of eccentricity. So you have big receptive fields in the periphery, small in the fovea. Did that?
Are there signals
Well, you could see. They tend to be a little elongated. They're not wildly different, but they tend to be elongated in the y direction. You know, if you looked at those. Not by much, maybe. It's hard to tell because there's two regions. You know, maybe like this is a little longer than this. But they, you know, they also, of course, vary. So I guess here's an example of plots of this as a function of x. Well, here's a plot of a Gaussian function as a function of y. It's trivial. It's just a Gaussian. But here's a plot of a function of x for different kinds of Gaussian functions. So, you know, here's one with more wiggles. As you change the preferred spatial phase, you can get anti-symmetric ones, symmetric ones, ones with no symmetry. You know, there's a range of stuff you get. Okay, so let me just show you. This is going to be kind of silly, maybe, but I'll do it in preparation for the space-time receptive fields. So a good way to figure out, you know, what kind of selectivity these are going to give. There's two ways to do it. There's sort of the easy picture way, and then the way to just calculate it. Is just to overlay these receptive fields on an image. So, for example, if you put a bar, which is a classic stimulus to use for these receptive fields, like this, and you have a receptive field, and I've just, you know, drawn one as circles, which consists of two on regions flanking a central off region, then clearly this neuron is going to respond very well if you do the following things. First of all, this, let me show you the spatial frequency selectivity. So this will be a very good stimulus for this neuron as far as bars go, because the dark bar is completely overlapping with the dark region. So you've got, let's say, two negatives multiplying within that integral, the negative of the stimulus because it's blacker than the background, the negative of the receptive field, so it's a region where D is negative. So you've got two negatives multiplying, which will make a large positive contribution. If you align this more like that, you won't get as good a response, because now part of the negative stimulus is overlapping with the positive part of the D function, and that's called spatial phase selectivity. So the spatial phase refers, it doesn't really apply very well to a bar, but nevertheless, we'll use the term, refers to the location along here of this image. Well, it really applies better with a grading. I'll show you that in a second. But there's if you want a position dependence, that you'll get the response going up and up, maximizing and then going down as you slide along here. You also see the orientation selectivity, right? If you orient the image like that, now you're no longer optimally overlapping the black region, and you're clipping a little bit the white region, so you'll get less of a response. So that's the basis of the orientation selectivity of this cell, that it likes to be aligned like that. And there's also a spatial frequency selectivity, namely, if we put in too wide of a bar like that, then now again, we're starting to invade the positive regions, and so the response will go down. So these neurons are selective to width, position, and orientation of images. And the best way actually to classify that is in terms of not a single bar, although that was the classic thing used by Hubel and Wiesel, but in terms of stripes like this, or more commonly a cosine grading. So in other words, if you make the spatial part of the receptor of the image a cosine, so some amplitude times the cosine. Actually, the way I really want to write it is like this: k cosine capital theta x plus k. I guess also spatial phase. Okay, so suppose you use an image like that. That's a classic cosine grading. Here, this is obviously just the amplitude of the image. K is the wavelength, so K determines, this obviously is not a cosine because I couldn't draw one, but a cosine, you know, the wavelength would determine the distance between the bars of the image. Theta would refer to its orientation. So theta equals 0 would be that, and then as I go to theta equals 90 degrees, do like that. So that's the orientation. And the spatial phase, in this case it's a better term, corresponds to, you know, where I am in this regard. And clearly you can see, you know, there's a optimally bad spatial phase, here's an optimally good spatial phase orientation. You can see all the selectivities from a grading like this. I want to leave these somewhere where I can get them. Okay, now a useful thing to do, I urge you to do it, let me put that down.
Yeah. Just taking, because almost the millisecond range looks kind of similar to the example. Is it just reflecting, say, the response from the
common plots, whatever? So there's two questions. So the velocity selectivity will come to. I think it's intimately related to that. The origin of it is more complex. You know, where does this double structure come from? When we do the LGN, I'll talk a little bit about that. But that's, in a sense, we should talk about that tomorrow because I'm sort of avoiding circuit issues. But there's a whole issue of what circuitry this comes from. I'm kind of avoiding it for now. I mean, let me come back and do that later. Okay, what was I doing? Okay, so another thing I really urge you to do, it's really kind of worth, I think it's worth doing, it's an instructive exercise, is if you want to determine the selectivities of visual neurons to different kinds of images, one thing to do is to take this sort of image, which is the classic thing used to characterize visual neurons, and multiply, do the integral. In other words, integrate the D function, which is the Gabor function, times this stimulus. And when you do that, you'll get an answer that depends on all of these different parameters. You can simplify it somewhat, but you'll get results that kind of look like this. So here is an example of the orientation selectivity. So you just plot this integral as a function of the orientation of the grating, and you'll see it's optimized for zero and falls off. You can look at its spatial frequency tuning. So how is it optimized for k? It responds best when the big K here equals the little k here, not surprisingly, but and then it falls off. You can look at the spatial phase dependence, and I want to look at that a little more carefully in a second. So it goes up and down as a function of spatial phase. And that's just all a function of doing the integral. Okay, so maybe I'll do complex cells. Yeah, okay. So let me write down the answer for doing this integral. This is one of the ones I would urge you to do. For the spatial part of the linear response, well, just the linear response, let's say, to a stimulus as a function of the spatial phase of the stimulus. So, in fact, to make life simple, we'll choose the optimal orientation, which is the state equals zero. We'll assume the optimal spatial frequency, which is big K equals little k. And then, although I guess the formula doesn't, I don't have to assume that. And then write down the response as a function of this phi. And again, as a function of both phi. So let me just write down the answer instead. Looks like this. A over 2, e to the minus sigma squared, k squared, over 2, cosine of the difference between the two phis. And then there's the time-dependent part, so times, an amplitude, I guess I'll call it B of omega. It's kind of a complicated expression, so I don't write that down. Okay? So in other words, the response to a stimulus that looks like a grating like this but oscillates in time is that the response is a cosine, oscillates in at least for a slow enough frequency, you know, oscillates with the grating. And then it varies as a cosine of the difference between the two angles. So if they're aligned, you get the maximum response. As they go out of alignment, the response goes down. Okay? And this factor is actually important. We're going to come back to that. So it goes like a cosine, not that surprisingly. Okay, now, I guess I'll just skip this. Maybe I should do. Okay, so that's the linear response. But we talked this morning about static nonlinearities. And so what's the deal on static nonlinearities? Well, the cells that I've been showing you up to now are what are called simple cells. And simple cells, from our point of view, means cells for which this program kind of works pretty well. So that we have this linear response. We have this linear response that we compute, and then we can get a pretty good estimate of the firing rate by taking a background rate and some function of this linear response. And it'll work pretty well. The kinds of functions people use are either threshold functions. So sometimes people just sort of rectify L. So sometimes I write that as F of L is just L rectified. So this little symbol means that this function is L if L is positive and it's 0 if L is negative. But an interesting proposal has been made by Heger and some of his collaborators that, in fact, what this function should really be is a squaring function. But then you should divide by a sum of L functions of neurons in the neighborhood of this neuron. So it's kind of a little extension of the static nonlinearity I talked about this morning, namely that the function for one neuron is affected by the responses of neurons around it. And they can explain various features of the interactions between receptive fields of different cells in this way. I'm not going to get into this, but I just thought I would mention it. The other thing that they explain this way is saturation. So this function, although it doesn't go negative, will just keep going up and up. But this function, as you get brighter and brighter, L will get bigger on the numerator, but so will it get bigger in the denominator, and the thing will saturate at some point. So that has that desirable feature. But I wanted to talk about another feature of this static nonlinearities, because there are a class of cells in primary visual cortex called complex cells for which it would appear that this program completely fails. Okay, and a nice way to see that is what happens if you look at the receptive field by doing a reverse correlation. Okay, and that's what I started to show you here. So here's what you get on the top. I can turn this upside down. So again, you take what's called a complex cell, and you'll see why it's called complex in a second, and you do a reverse correlation on it. What you get is a big blob. Okay, it looks like this. In other words, it looks like a receptive field with no structure whatsoever, just a blob. In other words, this would look like, if we took the linear model, this would look like a cell that just wants to see a blob of light in the middle there, nothing else. No structure to it, just a round dot of light. But in fact, if you study these cells, you find that just like simple cells, they, in fact, like best oriented bars. They like a bar that looks like goes like this. Furthermore, they're sensitive to the orientation of that bar. So this completely doesn't match the receptive field, which, I mean, forget about this blob, which looks round. You would say, well, how could it be sensitive to the orientation of the bar? And yet it is. It's as sensitive as a simple cell. It's also sensitive to the spatial frequency of a grating. So it wants to see, let's say, light bar there and a dark bar there, something like that. And yet there's no indication of it here like there was for these other receptive fields. So what's going on? Well, what's going on is that a complex cell has all of the selectivities as a simple cell, but it doesn't care about spatial phase. So in other words, if I go back to my plots like this, a complex cell, its receptive field would just look like a circle or something. It would just look like a blob. Okay? And so it would be hard to know what the hell's going on. But what you'd find is if you tip this, you get lesser response. You get a maximal response here. But if you move it, it doesn't care. So you get the same response there, 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 and there. And so it's like what's happening when you try to do a reverse correlation is that you're summing that stimulus plus that stimulus plus that stimulus plus that stimulus, and you're just smudging everything out. So it's a cell that doesn't seem to have this linear response. Now people have explained the responses of these cells in one way by going to the next term in the Wiener or the Wurtella expansion. In other words, these seem to be caring about squares of the stimulus. But in fact, there's a very nice way of modeling these, which makes them almost linear. And yet, let's get rid of the spatial phase. And it's based on just looking at this formula. So, if you look at the linear response you would expect from a simple cell as a function of spatial phase, and remember, spatial phase is the problem, it looks like this. Let's go to the case here. Let's go to the case where we're doing the optimal spatial frequency. So just to get rid of this factor, to just make life a little simpler. So the response looks like some function, some parameter. Let's call it, I'm running out of letters. I guess I called it A or 2B of omega. Some number. This is just constants. Never mind. Times the cosine of the angle between the preferred spatial phase of the neuron and the actual spatial phase, and then this oscillating term. But that's how a simple cell depends on spatial phase. It depends on the mismatch between the preferred spatial phase and the real spatial phase as a cosine. So somebody got the bright idea. I don't really know who to attribute it to because it sort of filters slowly into the literature. But I think Adelson, Bergen and Adelson really stated it most clearly. Had the bright idea that says, well, look, suppose I took a cell, suppose this was my cell 1, let's call this cell 1, and I imagined I had another simple cell, I'll call it simple cell 2, that was identical to simple cell 1, so all of these things would be the same, except the only difference is that its preferred spatial phase is shifted by 90 degrees. So whereas here this one's phi, the other one's going to be phi plus 90 degrees. But shifting a cosine by 90 degrees makes it into a sine. So this guy is going to have a spatial frequency selectivity that looks like that. Okay? Then they got the bright idea, wow, I know how to make a spatial phase independent cell. You just square these and add them, right? Because cosine squared plus sine squared is 1. So the what's called the energy model of complex cells is that it's almost a linear model. The only difference is that there's a static nonlinearity where you square, but it involves the sum of two linear terms. So the firing rate for a complex cell is again modeled as some sort of background. Plus, the static nonlinearity consists of taking these two things and squaring them and adding them. It's almost just a slight perturbation of the technique. And of course, when you do that, two things happen. Obviously you square all the constants in front. That doesn't really matter much. You get cosine squared plus sine squared. That adds up to 1. And then you get cosine squared omega t. So you actually come up with a prediction when you do this. First of all, you say, okay, this model, she doesn't explain anything. It accounts for the fact that complex cells are spatial phase independent. But it predicts something, and it predicts what's called frequency doubling. Namely, if you plot, I have a plot of this I can show you. God knows where it is, though. Here it is. If you plot the response of a simple cell to an oscillating gradient, so this is this time-dependent factor. This is the cosine whereby the stimulus is wiggling back and forth. If you plot the plot of a simple cell just follows that. The only thing is it gets rectified, right? It doesn't go below zero. So here's the response of a single cell. Firing rate blips. Every time blips. Every time that the stimulus goes on. And here's what this response predicted by this formula would be. A cosine squared has two properties. One is there's a sustained response. There's a DC component here to the response. And the other is that it wiggles at twice the frequency, whereas this is wiggling at whatever it is. This is wiggling twice as much. So it has what's called frequency doubling. And this is a classic effect of complex cells. In fact, this is the way people test complex cells. They oscillate a grating, and they see if they get a response at twice the frequency, and they know it's a complex cell. So this model is really quite successful. Again, it doesn't explain complex cells. And tomorrow, I'll present to you a model that attempts to explain how this arises on the basis of recurrent circuitry. But it accounts for their properties in a very nice, compact way.
Why can't those shearing and squaring, do you think? I mean, you should have a simple cell, which you're actually driving pretty hard to turn it off.
Mm-hmm. So another way to build, you're exactly right. Another way to build a simple cell response is to take a complex cell response, rather, is to take a simple cell like this, build another one that goes here, right? And add them up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not.
I
don't think the data can distinguish.
Data.
No, because that one will frequency double too. No, you can't distinguish between those two possibilities. I like this one because I think it's cute and neat, but you know, I don't think there's any way you can tell the difference between those two cases. So that's called summing quadrature pairs, right? I don't know why, because you know, one's like a sine, one's like a cosine, and it's like the integral of a cosine, you know, is a sine or so, whatever. So you could do it that way too. Okay, so let me finish up just by showing you directionally selective cells. I'll do that in a hurry. All right, I want to go back to simple cells, but we'll go back to complex cells and simple cells in a second. So I haven't done non-separable space-time receptive fields, but here's an example of that. So these are, again, X tau plots of the receptive of D and with Y thrown away. And here's a separable one. It considers some an on and an off region that, as you go backwards in time, turns into an off and an on region. So it's this classic flip. But you can see from the structure of this that you can approximate it pretty well by a spatial function with two blobs and a temporal function that flips sign. But here's one that clearly can't be done that way. It's tipped, right? So it looks just like a three-phase off, on, off, but it's tipped. And that makes it non-separable. You can't write that as a product of a function of space times function of time. So what are they good for? Well, let me show you. I'll show you how to model them, but it's pretty trivial. So for this, I got to show you the stimulus. I got to draw for you the stimulus in space-time, not in space. So I want you to imagine that the stimulus here is a moving grating, like this. So here's a grating moving to the left. But I want to plot it in the same coordinates I'm plotting the receptive field. So I'm going to plot it as a function of time and x. Okay? It's not a function of y anyway, so it doesn't matter. And then it'll look like this, right? It'll be a sloped grating, because this represents, you know, each bar moving to the left over time. So that's how I want you to think of it. Okay, and then this is the space-time receptive field of a separable neuron, okay? It's like the one I showed you before. It has an off-on region that flips over time to an on-off, just a sort of a cartoon version of it. Okay, so let's see how that responds to, say, you know, a grating like this. Now, this would be, if I plot this, now, in this case, I'm using the same picture, but it's to signify a different thing. In this case, x is supposed to be along the x-axis, but the vertical axis is time. Okay? So if I draw this, this would represent a space-time diagram of a stationary grating. Okay? It's not moving, it's just sitting there. And then, when I do a space-time receptive field like this, what it means is as time progresses, maybe I'll lower this down, since this is the last thing anyway. As time progresses, what you have to do is slide this template up the graph. So this vertical axis corresponds to the time at which you want to predict the firing rate, okay? Time is going up this way. And then what I have to do is start thinking about summing those receptive fields with the image. And what you can see is that this cell, like visual cortical cells, doesn't like static images, right? Because if you align it like that, then each black bar is going through both a white region and a black region, an on region and an off region. So you always are getting a sum of positive and negative terms. What this neuron likes to see is moving gratings, which is no big surprise, because that's what, I got to get it moving the right way, though. There we go. For example, there, if I line it like that, I can't see what I'm doing. Okay, so this represents a leftward moving grating, and right, there it goes, those stripes go, and I've chosen a particularly optimal time, a time when the black corresponds to the two blacks and the two whites are pretty much in whites. I didn't align it perfectly, but you see what I mean. So that's a time when this neuron's going to respond very well. Now later, as you drag this thing up the axis, you know, there's a bad time, there's a good time, bad time, good time. You're going to get an oscillating signal, but every once in a while, periodically, you're going to get a very good response. And particularly if I really angle this right, you can see, you can get it to line. So this is a, like many, most neurons in primary visual cortex, this is a neuron that likes to see moving gratings. Now, a confusion that costs me many unhappy days is that Hubel and Wiesel called these directionally selective neurons. But in the modern language, they're not called that, and I'll show you why. Because although this likes a moving grating, it doesn't care which way it moves. This is the difference between using bars and gratings. So here's a grating moving to the right, and you still can get a perfect alignment. So this is a neuron that likes speed, but it doesn't care about velocity. And that's the difference between a space-time separable and non-separable. So here is a non-separable receptive field. Remember I showed you the picture of that receptive field that just looked tipped, looked like an off-on, this would be a off-on-off, but it's just tipped over. If that is your space-time receptive field, then clearly the alignment that works well is something like that, right? So again, a grating moving to the left will get a good response. But unlike the other case, there's no way you can get it to work this way. So it's never going to respond very well. So this is a directionally selective neuron in the modern sense of the term. Whoops, except I've done it at a bad time. Like that. And you can really see it's kind of neat, because what's happening is as you move backwards in time, the receptive field is shifting, right? So it's quite obvious that it's directionally selective, because the receptive field, or if you want to go forwards in time, the receptive field drifts to the left as time goes on. So of course it wants to see things drifting to the left. And it's also velocity sensitive or speed sensitive, because if it goes too fast, it's not going to work. If it goes too slow, it's not going to work. So you get these velocity selective cells. And this coming back to your comment that it's clearly the sort of latencies that you get here are a consequence, you know, are setting the velocity selectivity. So that's basically the kinds of selectivities you get in primary visual cortex to a monocular, non-colored image. There's more to say about binocular signals and about color. And really, the goal of tomorrow is to try to construct models for where does, I don't think I'll do directional selectivity, but where does orientation selectivity come from, where do complex cells come from. And to do that, we're going to have to sort of learn how to build models of firing rates, not based on this sort of phenomenological description where you just put in a stimulus and get out a response, but based more on biophysics, on the way neurons fire, the way they respond to their inputs. We want models in which the inputs aren't stimuli but are other neurons, because after all, stimuli don't hit neurons, other neurons excite neurons. And so that's the game plan for tomorrow, to build the apparatus for those models and then to build some of the models and analyze possible models of where these selectivities arise from in a mechanistic way, whereas today is just sort of in a descriptive way. So I will quit, but I'll take questions and, you know, or come up afterwards for questions, whatever. Anybody have any questions? You have questions, or if you know people want to ask, if people want to leave, I don't care if you're tired. But feel free to ask. Yeah, David, you?
Oh, actually,
are you stretching?
I just had a little comment that when you showed that in the blackboard, the cells are separable. That the time response function separates out on a spatial pattern. But when they're not separable, right, then the time dependence will depend.
Right, right. It's much richer, and you know, and the integrals are that much harder to do. Right. And I should mention that the way that I construct these receptive fields for non-separable one, you notice they were just tipped, is to just take a Gabor function and just tip it in the space-time plane. That's not the way normally it's done, but it's the easiest way to do it. Just do a coordinate transformation that tips it.
You get
a nice description. And then just tip it in space-time. Right. And so you could either tip it in space or tip it in time. Yeah, it's more symmetric. What people usually do is use two Gabor functions offset in time. But why not just tip the thing? Because, we're not doing a mechanistic model here. We're just trying to describe the functions. Yeah?
Does Pauling mean that this memory
Right. And in fact, you know, the key to getting a directional selective cell is to link the two so that the amount of latency is linked to space somehow. Absolutely, yes. These are speed and direction selective tuned. Yeah, and in fact, I'm not going to do it with directional selectivity, but when we do these recurrent models, the whole issue is really whether that selectivity is just a straight, you know, they're driven that way, or whether it's essentially a resonant network phenomenon, that the reason that they like certain stimulus is that the whole network resonates. And we're going to look at those models because they're more interesting, and maybe they're even right, you know. Yes. Right. By this formalism, it would be a little awkward, right? By David, what David said, it would be better. So if you, so first of all, yes, there are a whole spectrum from simple to complex, and but they do tend to be sort of bimodal. I mean, it's not a complete it's not an arbitrary split. So if you look, for example, the ways simple cells and complex cells are categorized is, for example, looking at the amplitude of the frequency doubled to this frequency non-doubled component. And if you plot the distribution of cells as a function of that measure, you know, you sort of get a bimodal distribution where you call those ones the simple ones and those ones the complex, but they're definitely ones in the middle. By my squaring one, it would be kind of hard to do. By David's, it's easy to do. So maybe this is where the model that David liked is better. Namely, if you take a simple cell like this and you add to another simple cell but not as strong, then you won't totally fill it in and you'll get a sort of a half and half. In the model that I'll talk about tomorrow, it's very easy to get cells that are in the middle. But in the squaring description, it's a bit awkward. I guess you could say maybe you wouldn't perfectly add them in quadrature or something like that.